From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. In this program, we'll tell you about some diplomatic progress in dealing with South Sudan's conflict. We'll get some analysis on what a Turkish corruption scandal means for the government of Recep Tayyip Erdogan. And Egypt's government is getting tougher with the Muslim Brotherhood. I'm Michael Lippin. African mediators say they have held productive talks with South Sudan's President Salva Kiir on ending his country's spiraling unrest. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and Ethiopian Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn were among officials who met with Mr. Kiir in the capital Juba on Thursday. Ethiopian Foreign Minister Tedros Adhanom says they discussed how to end South Sudan's hostilities and what to do about detainees suspected of attempting a coup against the government.
The leaders also have underlined that the unconstitutional means to remove democratically elected government should be condemned, and they have condemned that. And any solution to this crisis should be through political dialogue.
Mr. Kiir has accused his ex-deputy and political rival Riek Machar of masterminding a coup attempt that sparked fierce fighting between loyalists of both men nearly 2 weeks ago. The president and his rival have said they are ready for dialogue. But Mr. Kiir's government has rejected Machar's demand that detained opposition leaders be released first. President Kiir, an ethnic Dinka, reiterated his offer to meet with Machar, an ethnic Nuer, in a Christmas Day message.
I express my willingness for dialogue with Dr. Riek Machar and his group for peaceful settlement of our differences. I also extended the same message to David Yao Yao and all other armed groups who had taken up arms against the state. All these efforts I have taken in search for peace.
Violence continued in South Sudan's oil-producing northern region as the talks got underway. The military said government troops were battling forces loyal to Machar in the towns of Bentiu and Malakal. UN officials say thousands of people may have been killed as ethnic Dinkas loyal to Mr. Kiir have fought against ethnic Nuers allied to Machar. 2013 appears to have been a year of greater global awareness about African terrorism. African nations such as Mali and Somalia made military gains against Islamist extremists. But those gains were followed by major terrorist attacks in neighboring countries, highlighting the persistence of the militant threat. VOA's Anne Look has more.
The year opened with a French military intervention in Mali. Al-Qaeda-linked fighters in control of the north were pushing south. Malian troops could not have held them back alone. But even as French and African troops liberated the north, jihadist fighters launched a revenge attack on a natural gas facility in Ain Amenas, Algeria, taking hundreds hostage and ultimately killing at least 36 foreigners. Somalia looked to be turning a corner at the start of 2013. Kenyan and African Union troops had chased the militant group Al-Shabaab from key urban strongholds. But in September, a small number of Al-Shabaab militants attacked an upscale Nairobi shopping mall, killing more than 60 people and laying bare phalanx by Kenyan security and intelligence agencies. The world watched as hundreds escaped.
All I could remember people saying is, lie down, lie down. And so everyone kept lying down, everyone was crawling.
Nigeria says it's turning the tide against the homegrown radical insurgency Boko Haram that it has wrestled with since 2009. In May, Nigeria began an offensive against the sect. The United Nations says that ongoing offensive has killed more than 1,200 people. Boko Haram continues to attack. An all-too-familiar pattern is playing out in Africa. Islamist insurgents seize territory where they can. They set up safe havens. They may even try to govern. But faced with military action, they abandon their urban fiefdoms and disperse. Some are killed. Others live to strike back, joined by more young recruits. Senegalese researcher Bakary Samb says military intervention, in particular by Western forces, feeds radicalization.
It's absurd to say you can make war on terrorism, which by nature is constantly regenerating and evolving. We also need to fight the causes of radicalization. Poverty, a sense of frustration and rejection by the state and underdevelopment.
Analysts say Al-Shabaab remains the most organized and far-reaching of the African Al-Qaeda affiliates, and that the publicity it got from the Westgate Mall attack revitalized the Al-Shabaab brand, helping it recruit internationally. A Horn of Africa expert in Nairobi, Abdiwahab Sheikh Abdisamed, says the international community must keep up the pressure.
They have an agenda beyond Somalia. They have an agenda beyond the region. They are going to Islamize the entire world by force, not by breaching, by force.
The United States and the European Union are keeping a close eye on these threats. But with the exception of France, which continues to battle militants in Mali, Western powers say that in the year ahead, they will continue with the more hands-off approach of financing, assisting, and training African troops to contain violent extremism. And look, VOA News, Dakar.
Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan has reshuffled his cabinet after three ministers resigned in connection with a high-level corruption inquiry. Late Wednesday, Mr. Erdogan replaced his ministers of Economy, Interior, and Environment. The sons of all three ministers were detained recently as part of a major corruption investigation of Mr. Erdogan's political allies. Prime Minister Erdogan replaced a total of 10 ministers as part of the reshuffle. The corruption case is one of the largest ever in Turkey. For some insight into how it's affecting Prime Minister Erdogan's decade in power, I spoke with analyst Jonathan Schanzer at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies in Washington.
Well, I think it's a very serious scandal. We're looking at a number of senior ministers, those who are part of the inner sanctum, all being implicated, of course, not convicted, but certainly implicated. Some have resigned. One has even called for the resignation of the prime minister himself. This has forced the prime minister to reshuffle his cabinet, adding 10 new ministers, and he is now fighting back, trying to deflect these charges. However, I think pressure is now mounting from the opposition and from the Turkish public who are demanding answers.
Why do you think the Turkish judiciary is going after Prime Minister Erdogan's allies in this situation?
Well, it's unclear exactly where this is all coming from. On the one hand, we hear that this all stems from a conflict among Islamists within Turkey, in other words, the ruling Justice and Development Party, AKP, versus the Gulenists. This is basically a group of Islamists who follow a leader who is actually based in the Pocono Mountains in Pennsylvania, and that there is a significant rift over foreign policy. There's also question right now as to whether the AKP has succumbed to massive corruption based on some of the dealings that they have had with Iran over the last several years, and there's been quite a bit of those in terms of Turkey helping Iran with sanctions busting. And so we're just trying to get a sense right now of what's happening, but certainly right now no clear answers.
Well, to what extent do you think this corruption investigation is related to Turkey's ongoing economic relationship with Iran?
Well, we can certainly say right now that there are links. We can't say beyond that. In other words, there have been a couple of people who have been implicated, one in particular who is an Iranian gold merchant. He has been at the center of this, at least as far as we can tell. Also, the CEO of Halk Bank, the state-owned bank in Turkey, has also been implicated. Reports indicate that he has that prosecutors went into his home and found $4.5 million in shoeboxes. This is the same bank that was helping to facilitate these gas for gold transactions that helped repatriate some $13 billion to Iran amidst the sanctions regime. So we're seeing a lot of indications that Iran is at the center of this. Although at the end of the day, it could actually be only a small amount. We just don't know how far this corruption investigation will go.
And that was Jonathan Schanzer, Vice President for Research at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, speaking with me earlier. Iran and the United States began talking to each other in 2013, easing some of the tension that has marked their relations for many years. The initial talks by the two sides about Iran's controversial nuclear program have not exactly been smooth. But as VOA's Jeff Selden reports, many Iranians appear to be warming to the idea of better ties with the United States.
It was an announcement that gave rise to hopes that had been dormant for decades.
Just now, I spoke on the phone with President Rouhani of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
U.S. President Barack Obama's cautious optimism soon echoed by Iranian President Hassan Rouhani, tweeting about the historic phone conversation. The late September call came at the end of Mr. Rouhani's first trip to the United Nations, when despite speculation about a chance encounter and a possible handshake, the two leaders failed to meet. For three decades, such an encounter was unthinkable. Memories of the Iranian Revolution and the Iran hostage crisis etched in the minds of many. But change seemed to start taking hold in June, when the support of Iran's leading reformists helped propel Mr. Rouhani into the presidency, sparking celebrations. With the president-elect quickly signaling a new tone from Tehran.
There exists an old wound, and it is necessary for it to close in order for it to heal.
But many in the U.S. remained wary, convinced that despite Iran's denials, Tehran was set on acquiring nuclear weapons. The Senate Armed Services Committee's James Inhofe.
You can't sit around and try to speculate, are they telling us the truth? Are they going to try to do something internationally and all that? No. They want to kill us.
And U.S. negotiator Wendy Sherman sparked outrage in Iran when telling Congress that with Tehran,
we know that deception is part of the DNA.
Still, negotiations moved forward, leading to an interim deal between Iran and the West.
This is only a first step. It's an important achievement, but this is a first step.
Middle East analyst Jim Phillips says getting beyond an interim deal and fostering better ties between Iran and the U.S., still anything but certain.
These temporary negotiations help both sides in the short run, but in the long run, I'm very pessimistic that a sustainable and acceptable deal can be negotiated with the regime unless it sees that as a necessary step to ensure its very survival.
But for those too young to remember the revolution and the hostage crisis, there's still hope. Ali, who asked we hide his identity to protect friends and family in Iran, grew up in Tehran and now studies in the U.S.
We want to see things normalized so we don't feel a bit of a tension within ourselves whether things are going to be safe.
A normalization he barely could have dreamed of a year ago that, as remote as it may prove to be, now has a chance. Jeff Selden, VOA News, Washington.
Egyptian authorities say a roadside blast has shattered the windows of a passenger bus in a Cairo suburb, injuring five people. The explosion came as Egypt's military-backed interim government tightened a crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood, an Islamist group it blames for recent attacks in the country. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Authorities on Thursday arrested at least 18 Muslim Brotherhood members, including a former member of parliament and a son of a top leader, on the grounds of belonging to a terrorist group. The action came after Egypt's interim government declared the Brotherhood to be a terrorist organization, broadening its authority to move against the opposition group. The interim government has arrested most of the Brotherhood's top leaders since the military ousted Islamist President Mohamed Morsi on July 3rd, following large popular demonstrations against him. A year earlier, in June 2012, Mr. Morsi was elected Egypt's president with 51.7% of the popular vote. In a Cairo suburb, Egyptian police combed through the wreckage of a Red City bus Thursday morning, picking through shards of glass from blown-out windows. A police detective said another homemade bomb was found nearby. The Interior Ministry described the attack as an attempt to intimidate voters ahead of a referendum next month on a new constitution, part of a plan for a democratic transition. The constitution will replace one adopted while the Muslim Brotherhood controlled Egypt's parliament. The decision to declare the group a terrorist organization followed a Tuesday bombing which left 15 dead and scores wounded outside police headquarters in Mansoura, north of Cairo. Saeed Sadek, who teaches political sociology at the American University in Cairo, says the government move against the Brotherhood follows public outrage at the spate of recent terrorist attacks in the Sinai and several Egyptian cities.
This decision is a blow to the Muslim Brotherhood. It will undermine the membership in the group because members of the Muslim Brotherhood are not all at the same level of ideological commitment and dedication. And it may push some people to freeze the membership or not be active because they are scared.
A spokesman for Egypt's interior ministry told government TV Thursday that anyone participating in Brotherhood protests would be sentenced to 5 years in prison. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
And this is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. A little later in the show, we'll tell you about an extreme sport that is gaining lots of followers in Egypt.
It's that time. The 2014 VOA calendars are here, and we're ready to send one to you. All you have to do is email to us your name and complete mailing address, including all the appropriate codes. It would also be helpful if you would write your address in your local language as well as English. Send your email to voaasia@voanews.com. Once again, send us your name and complete mailing address, both in English and your local language, to voaasia@voanews.com. We're looking forward to hearing from you.
Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has honored his nation's war dead at a Tokyo shrine, seen by many of Japan's neighbors as a symbol of its militaristic past. Thursday's visit to the Yasukuni Shrine was the first by a sitting Japanese prime minister since 2006. It was quickly condemned by South Korea and China, both of whom say they were victims of Imperial Japan's aggression. Mr. Abe downplayed the political impact of his visit, saying it was not meant to hurt the feelings of Japan's neighbors. Mr. Abe said, I prayed for the souls of all the people whose lives were taken by war. Additionally, I made a vow to renounce war, and I was emboldened to create an era where people's lives will not be engulfed and pained by the misery of war. The Shinto shrine honors Japan's nearly 2.5 million war dead, including 14 convicted World War II war criminals. China's foreign ministry spokesman Chen Gang strongly criticized Mr. Abe's action as absolutely unacceptable to the Chinese people. Chen said, the Chinese government solemnly condemns Japanese leaders ruthlessly trampling on the feelings of the Chinese people and the people of other war-affected Asian countries. South Korea labeled Mr. Abe's move as anachronistic and said it will hurt bilateral ties. Thailand's government says it will not delay an early election scheduled for February, despite an appeal by electoral authorities for more time. The country's deputy prime minister, Pongtep Tepkanyana, made the announcement on Thursday, saying the original date of February 2nd will stand. Thai Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat called for the early vote in a bid to end a political crisis. Opposition protesters want her to quit, saying that would help to purge the country of corruption. A confrontation between the protesters and police in Bangkok turned deadly on Thursday, with one officer killed and dozens of people injured. A police spokesman accused some demonstrators of opening fire with guns. Many protesters threw stones while police responded with tear gas. Now, in Egypt, a growing number of young men are embracing a new athletic activity despite a tense security situation in the country. It's got them climbing walls, jumping over cars, and doing somersaults on sidewalks. Sebastian Mayer has this report on the parkour enthusiasts in the Egyptian capital.
Friday morning in the suburbs of Cairo. A dozen young men meet to practice parkour, the urban gymnastics craze that swept the world. Come rain or shine, the group called PKE, or Parkour Egypt, meets every week to work on moves. The few onlookers seem impressed, although Ahmed Nasser Saif says they're not always appreciated.
They call me a crazy man, or they don't know what I do, so I'm a stranger for that life. Why I run, why I climb some buildings.
But the sport may have advantages in today's Egypt, where crime is on the rise. Some of these men say they've used parkour to chase down criminals. Mustafa Kosha, one of the coaches, says he nabbed a pickpocket a few months ago.
That guy stole something from a girl on the run. We ran after him. And because of the parkour, we couldn't choose the shortest way to run. He was moving behind the cars, and we jump over the car. We can't do anything like that. So we caught him, and he's in a police station right now.
Parkour has also been useful for Egypt's film and TV industry. Companies like Moby Neal and Jeep use it for stunts in their commercials. As with all sports, parkour builds self-confidence, says Ahmed Mohamed Munir.
Parkour gives me a very big self-confidence. I can jump, I can go, I can run. So this gives me very high self-confidence.
But in a country where the streets are better known for tear gas and street battles than gymnastics, parkour is said to encourage camaraderie.
Parkour brings people together. I saw people, they are now my best friends. We are out together, we train together. And it's a different lifestyle. And I love parkour because of that. Yeah.
As Egypt continues to fracture, nothing stops these young men from training. Not divisive politics, nor bad weather. For VOA News, Sebastian Meyer, Cairo, Egypt.
Now, if you want to see these guys in action, check out the video version of this story on our YouTube channel, VOA Video, that's one word, and then click on Recent Activity to find the report, which was posted on December 24th. Here in the United States, the 7-day festival of Kwanzaa has begun. As VOA's Mike O'Sullivan reports, it's a time when African Americans highlight their heritage.
Maulana Karenga, a black activist and African studies professor, created Kwanzaa in 1966 to, as he said, give blacks an opportunity to celebrate themselves and their history. Each day is dedicated to a different principle, and a candle is lit each night. At a recent festival at the California African American Museum, Babe Evans explained the principles behind the upcoming holiday to a group of children. The first is unity.
It means a time of repose. It means a time to think about your ancestors, to think about the struggles that people have been through so that you can now have a life that is much more open.
Kwanzaa is based on African themes. Its principles are stated in the Swahili language, and the name Kwanzaa comes from a phrase meaning first fruits of the harvest.
The second day, because it's a 7-day ceremony, is Kujichagulia. And that means self-determination.
Collective work and responsibility, cooperative economics, purpose, creativity, and faith. These round out the 7 principles of Kwanzaa. Gift-giving is part of the holiday, but actor Jeffrey Anderson Gunther says the celebration has not become commercialized like Christmas.
When in Kwanzaa, we make our gifts. All the kids will make something and give to each other, and then we have an abundance of food and stuff that's shared.
In many African-American homes, Kwanzaa is celebrated along with Christmas. Writer Marsha Bullock, whose family is Christian, says that's what her family does.
We do Christmas, and then we do Kwanzaa starts like directly the day after, so we do that too. And then, my favorite part is the celebration where you get to eat everything.
The festival will end January 1st with a feast with friends and family. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Well, that brings our international edition to an end. Send us an email with your thoughts about the show. The address is voaasia@voanews.com. You can also send me your feedback on Twitter. My username is @Michael_Lippin, spelled L-I-P-I-N. Our studio director was Patrice Martin, assisted by engineer Kwasi Smith. I'm Michael Lippin. Thanks for spending part of your day with us, and happy Kwanzaa.